Today is Thursday, May 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. North Korea has raised questions about if the upcoming summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un will continue. However, there's been no word that the meeting has been canceled.
So everything's a green light and on the go as far as we're concerned, unless things change between now and June 12th.
Also ahead, Israeli forces conducted overnight airstrikes in Gaza after their forces came under fire on Wednesday. Plus a look at American Meghan Markle as she prepares to join Britain's royal family this weekend. It's all ahead on International Edition. South Korea said it will act as a go-between after North Korea threatened to pull out of planned U.S.-North Korean talks in Singapore next month. A presidential Blue House spokesman said members of the country's National Security Council Standing Committee decided to closely coordinate stances of both countries through various channels so the upcoming U.S.-North Korean summit is held successfully in a manner of mutual respect. North Korea raised questions whether the June 12th meeting in Singapore will take place after raising objections on Wednesday over Washington's insistence it unilaterally disarm its nuclear program as well as ongoing joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises. James Kim is a research fellow at the Seoul-based Asan Institute for Policy Studies. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty South Korea views its role as more of a facilitator, not a mediator.
It has allowed for the two parties, in this case North Korea and the United States, to come together for a meeting in June. In terms of President Moon's abilities to somehow get both the United States and North Korea to make compromises on their position, I'm a little skeptical as to whether he has enough leverage there to make that kind of proposal, largely because I think all the leverage at the moment about what will be discussed on June 12th depends on both what Chairman Kim Jong-un thinks about the right kind of arrangement is and what Donald Trump thinks is right.
As you know, James, Mr. Moon plans to be in Washington next Tuesday. What will the message be?
I think the message is going to be that South Korea is on board with the United States on the maximum pressure and engagement approach, that he wishes them well during the talks and summit in June. He may provide some clues or signals about hints as to what the North Koreans would like to see, but I don't think he's going to be able to dictate to President Trump what he thinks the United States should do during that meeting.
Mr. Trump has indicated that he's gotten no message from North Korea saying that the meeting is off. How likely now, given the North's recent statements, do you think the summit will be between the U.S. and North Korea?
I believe the official position of the United States is the only thing that we can go with at the moment. And North Korea has never issued an official statement that the talks are off. So everything's a green light and on the go as far as we're concerned, unless things change between now and June 12th.
Well, China has indicated that it wants the talks to go on. Will that help North Korea make up its mind?
I don't think there's a very big change here on the part of North Korea. The latest statement was largely directed towards National Security Advisor John Bolton and his statements. Any action that North Korea has taken was directed at towards South Korean government more so than it was towards the United States. So nothing suggests to me that the talks are off at this moment.
Were you surprised that North Korea canceled the high-level talks with South Korea?
No, this is par for the course for North Korea. We've seen these kinds of moves before. What surprised me was the response from the United States. It was more subdued than I expected.
Why do you say that?
This meeting was made possible by President Trump agreeing to the meeting. President Trump still has the decisive leverage here to call off the meeting if he would like. But the fact that he didn't make any signals or respond in any way to the latest statement suggests to me that he wants to move ahead with this talk just as much as South Korean President Moon Jae-in would also like this talk to move forward.
White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders said on Wednesday the Trump administration remains hopeful the meeting in Singapore will take place and that President Trump is ready for tough sanctions. She also said if there is no meeting, the maximum pressure campaign on Pyongyang will continue. Now, VOA's Sarah Williams joins us for a quick look at what's happening online.
Trending today, hashtag Ebola. The World Health Organization says the outbreak of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo has spread to a city, raising fears of a new epidemic of the deadly virus. Reuters World tweets, just in, Congo Health Minister announces case of Ebola in the northwest city of Mbandaka, which has a population of 1 million. The World Health Organization tweets, a first batch of 4,000 hashtag Ebola vaccine doses just arrived in Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of the Congo. Additional doses should be deployed in the coming days to hashtag DRC. There are ongoing preparations to start the ring vaccination as soon as possible. Dr. Tedros tweets, one new hashtag Ebola case has been confirmed in an urban area of hashtag DRC. This is a concerning development, but we now have better tools than ever before to combat Ebola. WHO is deploying more experts. Together with our partners, we are taking decisive action to stop the outbreak. Vox tweets, it's the first time a vaccine is being used to fight a new outbreak of the deadly virus. It could save lives and prevent another public health nightmare. Also trending is hashtag graduation advice in 5 words. Yes, it's graduation time here in the United States. Throughout the country, many prominent people are invited to give graduates their words of wisdom concerning careers and life in general. But on Twitter, many people are giving short summaries of advice. Scott Williams tweets, it doesn't get any easier. Jay Marie tweets, be prepared for student loans. Mill Runner tweets, don't settle for boring jobs. Rose Ghost tweets, add more insulation to basement. And finally, Carrie Teddy tweets, don't take advice from Twitter. And that's a look at social media.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Around the globe, here are some more of the world's top stories. Pakistani authorities say security forces have hunted down and killed a senior pro-Islamic State militant commander wanted for slaughtering more than 100 minority Shiite Muslims and police personnel. Malaysian police early Thursday raided former Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak's home and other properties searching for documents related to charges in a multi-billion dollar scandal involving the State Development Fund 1MDB. And the World Health Organization says the outbreak of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo has spread to Mbandaka, raising fears of a new epidemic of the deadly virus. For additional stories and in-depth coverage, be sure to visit voanews.com or download our mobile application to take the stories with you. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Advancing technology in astronomy is helping scientists learn more about the origins of our universe and its cosmic elements such as stars and planets. Using sophisticated observation facilities located in northern Chile, astronomers gathered evidence of star formation just 250 million years after the Big Bang. Their observations also helped them detect the most distant oxygen in the universe. The astronomers made their findings by studying a galaxy some 13.3 billion light-years away. Taking data from the Hubble Space Telescope and NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope, the scientists reconstructed the history of this galaxy and were able to determine by its observed brightness that star formation began there 250 million years after the Big Bang. The astronomers' findings were recently published in the journal Nature. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
International edition continues on the Voice of America. The Israeli military says it has carried out airstrikes on militant sites in Gaza overnight in response to machine gun fire that hit a building in the Israeli city of Sderot. The army said planes bombarded a military compound and a weapons production facility in the northern Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Health Ministry says a man was moderately wounded by shrapnel, but didn't say whether he was inside a militant site or just nearby. VOA Middle East correspondent Heather Murdoch is in Israel, and this morning she was woken up by the sounds of those explosions. Heather, can you kind of take us through what you heard this morning?
Well, early this morning, starting about 12:30 a.m., There were bomb blasts in the Gaza Strip. The first was about 4 kilometers from me, so I wasn't quite sure what it was until I got word from a colleague across town who was saying a Hamas facility was bombed. Shortly thereafter, there were several other bomb blasts. We heard, I personally heard 5, and my colleagues did too, but said they heard there were more in the Gaza Strip that night. It went on in total for about a half hour, and the local journalists were telling me that they believed that it was all Hamas facilities that were targeted late that night, and that was later affirmed in the morning.
Now, this comes after some Israeli facilities were hit by gunfire in Sarot. Has the government come out and said anything more about these airstrikes that were carried out in the wee hours of Thursday morning?
The Israeli government is very quiet about these actions. And what's interesting is the public in Gaza is not largely concerned with them. They're actually mostly saying that they're just happy to happen at night in places that people aren't living, which is unusual that a population would be so unconcerned with bombings of their area, but they're far more concerned with what happens when they protest and the amount of deaths and injuries that have happened in the past week.
Speaking of protests, a Hamas leader appeared on television on Wednesday saying that some 50 or so of those killed in Monday's clashes were actually part of the Hamas group. Has there been any official reaction to that comment?
There have been a lot of pro-Israeli commentators that have taken that statement to be proof that Hamas was behind the protests over the past month, and evidence that the public that joined was forced to join. And it is true that Hamas, from the view on the ground, you can see that Hamas not only encourages the protests, they also organize the protests and set up tents and bathrooms and make it possible for people to protest in relative comfort. But it's not entirely true that the public is forced. A lot of the Hamas message that galvanizes the public is something that's part of the collective consciousness of Palestinians in general. They talk a lot about the right to return to lands that are now Israel, that their forefathers were forced out of, some of which over 70 years ago. So the public is very open to hearing that particular message, but there's no doubt that not only did Hamas members encourage the protest, help organize the protest, they also took part.
Heather Murdock is VOA's Middle East correspondent, speaking to us by phone. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Burundi is voting in a referendum that would allow President Pierre Nkurunziza to add another 2 terms to the 3 he's already served. His opponents say they've been harassed and threatened, and there are fears of ethnic conflict and further repression. Reuters' Lucy Fielder has that story.
Burundi's president, voting Thursday in a referendum to keep himself in power until 2034. Pierre Nkurunziza won a controversial 3rd term 3 years ago, prompting opponents to take up arms against him. Nearly 500,000 people have fled since.
The day has finally arrived, May 17, 2018. We are very happy that the people woke up early in the morning to vote yes or no for the amendment of the constitution.
More violence before this referendum has raised fears of harsher repression and ethnic conflict. The slaughter of 28 people, many of them women and children, in this northwestern village last week was seen as a warning to vote for the changes. And Nkurunziza's party has given him the title visionary, and he'll probably get his wish for constitutional amendments that will let him run for 2 more 7-year terms. Rights groups put that down to fear. Opposition figures say dissidents have been arrested, no rallies broken up. They say the youth wing of the ruling party tours villages, threatening opponents with death. Those who vote against have been called enemies of the nation. So the vote is expected to proceed in a tense calm. Burundi, one of the world's poorest countries, is no stranger to ethnic conflict. Its ethnic makeup is the same as neighbouring Rwanda, where 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus perished in the 1994 genocide. Nkurunziza himself is a former guerrilla leader from the Hutu majority, who has ruled since Burundi's civil war ended 13 years ago. The government says the vote will be free and fair and denies allegations of repression.
That was Reuters' Lucy Fielder reporting. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. On Friday, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres will meet U.S. President Donald Trump at the White House for their first meeting since the American president pulled out of the Iran nuclear agreement. Trump's decision could complicate negotiations over North Korea's nuclear program, and as VOA's Bill Gallo reports, it also raises questions about what role the U.N. will play in any denuclearization process with Pyongyang.
Since the 2015 Iran nuclear deal was signed, the United Nations Atomic Watchdog, the IAEA, has been clear that the deal subjects Iran to the world's most robust regime of inspections.
We have had access to all locations that we needed to visit.
But President Trump disagreed. He cited the access issue when he pulled out of the deal earlier this month.
The deal's inspection provisions lack adequate mechanisms to prevent, detect, and punish cheating.
John Bolton, Trump's national security advisor, echoed that sentiment in an interview with VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren.
We entered the deal without knowing anything other than what our own intelligence had given us on Iran's military program, and the IAEA simply didn't have adequate provisions for inspections.
Those comments could make for a tense discussion when UN Chief Antonio Guterres visits the White House Friday. Guterres had urged Trump to stay in the deal and expressed deep concern when the U.S. left. It also raises the question of how much, if at all, the U.S. will rely on the IAEA in nuclear talks with North Korea, says former IAEA inspector Robert Kelly.
My guess is that John Bolton is not going to turn to the United Nations and the IAEA and say, go do this job. Bolton has a long history of not liking the United Nations, of making strong statements about it, and not particularly liking the IAEA.
Bolton, who served as the U.S. ambassador at the U.N. under President George W. Bush, once said if the U.N. headquarters in New York lost 10 stories, it wouldn't make a bit of difference. If the U.S. is hesitant to involve international organizations in a possible North Korea deal, there are groups within the U.S. defense and energy departments that could theoretically do the job, Kelly says.
And those people are prepared to go. They're prepared to go on a moment's notice. They're probably packing the gear right now.
It's far from certain what Trump will ultimately decide. One hint came last week when a senior U.S. official said despite Washington pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, it still expects the IAEA to continue their inspections of Iran's nuclear sites. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Washington.
People in her hometown of Los Angeles remember actress Meghan Markle as a charitable young girl who sparkled on stage. On Saturday, the entire world will be watching Markle as she officially ties the knot to England's most eligible bachelor. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo takes a look at Markle's fairy tale life and the prince, who some say is really the lucky one.
It soon became obvious that what started out as a blind date had developed into something more after young Prince Harry and American actress Meghan Markle were seen in public last September holding hands. 2 months later, the couple were engaged.
Congratulations!
Markle's path to royalty started in the Los Angeles neighborhood of Hollywood, where she attended a Catholic high school. One of her teachers has been following her career.
I was actually showing her speech to the UN before she got engaged to Prince Harry, simply because here's an alum who's gone out. She has a wonderful career. She's very successful. But she has this sense of, I need to give back.
But Christine Knudsen says it was Markle's poise and confidence that made her stand out.
Instead of complaining about something, let's think about what we might be able to do to change it.
Those qualities prompted another high school teacher to reflect on her prince.
My first thought really truly was, he is so lucky. He has no idea.
Markle, who starred in a number of TV shows, made her stage debut in this auditorium. She's remembered as a young lady who sparkled on stage but always found time to help those less fortunate. Her high school teacher, Maria Polia, pushed Markle to overcome her initial shyness and encouraged her to volunteer at a soup kitchen in a poor neighborhood.
What's memorable for me about Megan was her work on Skid Row. With homeless people. It wasn't just handing out the food for the day. It was really getting to know the people, knowing their names, knowing their stories.
Her alma mater plans to host a tea party to celebrate Markle's transformation from student to TV star to Her Royal Highness on May 19th. Despite the nine-hour difference, the early morning viewing party for the wedding is expected to draw a big crowd of teachers, former classmates, and her growing legion of fans. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
And that is going to do it for us today. I'd like to thank Patrice Martin for directing the show and Wojciech Zorniak for engineering the broadcast. But most importantly, I want to thank you for spending part of your day listening to International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have an absolutely fantastic day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month, Israel celebrated its 70th anniversary of independence. Speaking on the occasion, Vice President Mike Pence said, "We gather here to celebrate nothing less than a miracle of history. The day when the Jewish people ended the longest exile of any people anywhere and reclaimed a Jewish future and rebuilt the Jewish state." The United States of America, said Vice President Pence, was proud to be the first nation in the world to recognize the State of Israel 7 decades ago. And just as President Harry Truman made history then, President Donald Trump made history now, almost exactly 70 years to the minute from the rebirth of the Jewish state, the American embassy officially opened in Jerusalem, the capital of the State of Israel. By finally recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the United States has chosen fact over fiction. And fact is the only true foundation for a just and lasting peace, said Vice President Pence. The United States believes peace is possible between the Palestinians and Israelis. And while any peace will undoubtedly require compromise, Mr. Pence reiterated that the United States will never compromise the safety and security of the State of Israel. The United States and Israel will continue to confront the evil scourge of radical Islamic terrorism. That's why the United States is leading the free world in standing up to Iran, the leading state sponsor of terror, by withdrawing America from the Iran nuclear deal. The United States, stressed Mr. Pence, will never allow Iran to obtain a nuclear weapon. In 70 short years, Israel has become one of the freest, strongest, and most prosperous nations on earth. As Vice President Pence said, "We stand with Israel because her cause is our cause, her values our values, and her fight is our fight. We stand with Israel because we believe in right over wrong and good over evil and liberty over tyranny." With the support of the United States and with God's help, said Vice President Pence, "I know Israel will go from strength to strength. Her first 70 years will just be a glimpse of what's to come. And the United States and Israel will meet our glorious future together."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.